This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Lots of people think that television is ruining our values and our children's values, but not TV critic John Leonard. He says we'd actually be a kinder, gentler nation if we embraced the scruples and imitated the behaviors recommended by most entertainment programs. John Leonard has a new book called Smoke and Mirrors: Violence, Television, and Other American Cultures. He's TV critic for CBS Sunday Morning and New York Magazine. He loves TV, but he's also devoted much of his life to books. He's former editor of the New York Times Sunday Book Review, current literary editor of The Nation, and former book critic for Fresh Air. I asked him what his current favorite programs are.
Well, the programs that I watch as a civilian include Homicide, which I make sure to watch every Friday night. I think the acting and the writing and the cinematography is fabulous, and it's like reading a very good short story every week. I will be watching. I've watched the first 10 hours of Easy Streets, which has begun a spring run that none of us knows how long it will last on CBS. Is on 10 o'clock on Wednesday nights. And Paul Haggis, who did this Due South program, wonderful program about a Canadian Mountie who comes to Chicago, has now done this sort of ghetto urban wasteland program where everybody is suspect and everybody is corrupt, and it's wonderfully written and wonderfully acted. So that I've watched the first 10 hours of, and I recommend it to everyone. It's those 10 o'clock shows that I tend to point toward because of the writers especially. I mean, David Kelly writing for Chicago Hope on Monday nights, and all the guys who write the Law and Order scripts, which are really tight and complicated and put a reverse spin on things. These are my enjoyments that I watch for strictly entertainment value. Otherwise, it's basketball.
You probably watch more TV than a lot of the people listening to us now watch. I wonder how much television you think is violent or has a lot of sexual innuendo in it, the kind of thing that might make a lot of parents uncomfortable if they knew their children were watching it.
Yeah, well, it depends on what concerns you. I think that I'm tired, but then, you know, I am approaching my 58th birthday. I'm fatigued at the sexual innuendo in situation comedies. At 8 o'clock, at 8:30, I don't want to stamp it out. I just find it tiresome. I find it juvenile. I find even situation comedies that I respect, like Mad About You and Seinfeld, you know, devote whole episodes to variations on a theme of penis. And I say, Jesus, it's junior high school. Who needs this? I think on network television, there's a lot more sexual innuendo. And I stress this, network primetime television, there's a lot more sexual innuendo than there is the kind of violence that frightens so many other people. The right wing in this country seems to be much more worried about sex, and the left wing much more worried about violence. Most of the violence is either in syndication or most graphically on cable television, and usually pay cable television, where you have to pay a premium, so it's probably not the children of the poor that are doing all of that watching. That's where you see the graphic stuff, and it was made for the big screen Hollywood and then shows up in our living room.
You point out that a lot of cable is, as you put it, wholesome to the verge of stupefaction. Mm-hmm. Disney, Discovery, Learning, mm-hmm. Family, History, Nashville, Nickelodeon mm-hmm. channels.
If you actually channel surf, what you get is so much family, so many horses, so many crazy archaeologists in the sun-stunned, goat-munched desert digging up a bone or a toenail. So much sports scores, so much. You have channels for food, you have channels for weather, you have channels for shopping.
Religion.
Yeah, religion. We have to remember that, you know, this machine, which has something going on 24 hours a day, all the time, always available at the flick of a switch. This machine contains everything, and whatever is on when you turn it on also constitutes television. Years ago, I had an argument with Lionel Trilling, who deplored the fact that I was writing about television for Life magazine while I was editing the New York Times Book Review. He considered it unseemly and anti-intellectual. But I could sit down and get him to admit it was hard that with the television set on in his house, he got up to 11 hours a week. He was appalled. His wife, Diana, was even more appalled. But it was true. He just didn't call it television. It was old movies that he remembered from the 30s and 40s that he cared about. It was Knicks games, which was basketball. That wasn't television. It was a moonshot or something like that. That was news. And the one program he would admit to was Kojak. He was devoted to Kojak. But it was television because it was on television, and that's what television is. It's this great cannibal of the culture that puts everything on and regurgitates it out and is available and juxtaposed all of it. And television is old television as well as new television.
Well, exactly.
It is reruns.
Yeah, no, that's the point I want to get to next, because television is more and more becoming a museum of itself.
Yeah, well, that's the odd thing, because it becomes an archaeological museum at the same time as it is, as it's a hothouse at the same time that it's cutting edge.
You've been watching television since the late 40s, right?
Well, early 50s. More like 1951, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So a lot of the shows that are back on in syndication or in reruns in TV Land or Nick at Night, you saw them the first time around. And I'm wondering if any of these shows look really different to you now, if you're reevaluating any of them, or if your opinions are the same now as they were the first time.
Of course, they're different. I was a kid. The biggest surprise for me, and you won't see it too much even on Nickelodeon, which specializes in series, you know, reruns of series programs, but the biggest surprise is to go back to the so-called golden age of television, where usually you have to go to the Museum of Broadcasting and see all those Playhouse 90 plays and U.S. Steel Hour dramas and the rest of it that we talk about is wonderful because they had Broadway actors and they had real writers and everything. Well, you know, it was bargain basement neo-Italian realism, kitchen sink Freud, and everybody did a lot of shouting and a lot of grunting, and it was considered authentic. And I consider it pretty dreary stuff, and not remotely to compare with the quality of both writing and of acting and of film editing we associate with programs like Hell Street Blues or China Beach or Homicide. Some wonderful things have appeared on television, and for the most part, they have expressed themselves in series programs with ensembles of quite intelligent and talented people.
My guest is TV critic John Leonard. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Leonard, TV critic for CBS Sunday Morning and New York Magazine. He's written a new book about TV called Smoke and Mirrors. You know what I think is an interesting change in television? When I grew up, you might watch TV or reruns of TV ironically. You might have watched Leave It to Beaver or Ozzie and Harriet as ironic, but now you're told that it's ironic. It's presented in an ironic context. You know, you don't have to figure that out for yourself.
You know how hard it is to be postmodern? You know, it's really hard to be postmodern. If no text has more value than any other text, and there's always some superscript or subtext that only the postmodernist can figure out, and you begin by putting every single emotion and every single sort of honest, spontaneous response in quotation marks, then when you move those quotation marks around and you have reruns of the words in quotation marks, you have to have quotation marks around those or parentheses. It's why their prose is so miserable coming out of the Academy, is that you're afraid to have any kind of honest reaction because somebody will think that you're naive. And then after you've gone through that period, I mean, most people watch Melrose Place. Most of the people that I know that watch Melrose Place watch it in a heavy state of irony. But you're quite right. When it goes into reruns, and some of it has gone into reruns, well, at least Beverly Hills has gone into reruns, how are we to watch it if we watched it ironically the first time? Trying to remember what it was like to be ironic, the way we try with other programs to remember what it was like to be romantic, I think it's very hard. I think we've lost a capacity for the innocent enjoyment of entertainment, and until we find a substitute for that innocent enjoyment of entertainment, dare I suggest great art, we are stuck watching ourselves watch, which used to be Camus' definition of what an intellectual did, watching his mind, but we're not watching our minds. We're watching our emotional body temperature.
Yeah, I mean, on places like at Nick at Night, TV shows are presented with the quotation marks already around the TV shows. They are presented in an ironic context.
Mm-hmm. And yet, you can still struggle back. I write in the book of, you know, I felt a little guilty because I've been a television critic, and you review books in advance, rather you review tape of programs before the programs are actually out. You don't see them with commercials. It's a hothouse atmosphere, and it's a little distorting. But at the time, which was 11 years ago, really, that I'd come out of the hospital and was recovering from alcoholism and various other seizures and everything, and my metabolism was entirely screwed up. I could not sleep ever. I just simply couldn't go to sleep. I started watching late at night anything that was on, because you can only read so many books and so many magazines, and you can only do so much writing, and there are these hours still stretch out before you. So I started watching this stuff, and I started watching it, I thought, as an archaeologist. Well, this was before Nick at Night. And at 3:30 in the morning, you got back-to-back reruns of Mary Tyler Moore.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, in that stage, and I suddenly found myself both a civilian and somebody who was quite needy. At that stage, with what I needed and what I was getting, when she threw her hat in the air, I was thrilled. And I felt younger. And I felt better about myself. And I felt better about her. And I got a satisfaction that I hadn't expected, and I had to remind myself that these satisfactions, as well as some alarms, are available to everybody depending on the appetite we bring. I brought that at 3:00 in the morning because I couldn't sleep, and I got back something like a gift of grace.
Yeah, well, Mary Tyler Moore is such a good show. Anyways, what's really creepy is when you're kind of reduced to tears watching something that you know is drac, but you're just very emotionally vulnerable at the moment.
Well, we have to take our emotions where we can get them, right?
So how does drinking look to you on television? There's so many series in which a character drinks and where that character may or may not realize they have a problem.
Yeah, it's not as bad as it used to be. Oddly enough, you know, one of the first people who was so sensitive to this was Stephen Bochco. And very early on in Hill Street Blues, you had one of the cops who clearly had a drinking problem and was out of control, and everybody was worried about him. And when he finally got to an AA meeting, there was Farrillo, his boss, the captain, already at the AA meeting. And then you look, and in every show that Bochco has done since, except the situation comedy shows, the problems of alcoholism have come up, and the glamorizing of the drinking has disappeared. It's just not there. The same is true of Cagney and Lacey. I mean, that was scary in the last year, 2 years of that show on the air, as Cagney clearly had a drinking problem, as her father had died of alcoholism. They took her all the way through denial and every stage of it until she went into AA, and then they showed her at AA meetings, which was extraordinary. I mean, it's the opposite of Murphy Brown, where, sure, she drank and she stopped and it never came up again. I don't think the drinking is glamorized as much as it used to be. I think still in situation comedies, it's an excuse for an easy joke. It's still a temptation in all comedy or even in some drama to let an actor do a drunk scene to prove certain skills. I'm not to be trusted on some of that because I bring my own baggage to it. I look at it; it makes me uncomfortable. I don't need to see it. I don't want to. I don't want to go to a movie like Francis anymore. I didn't even, as I again say in the book, but that's again a private response, absolutely personal. I'm one of those people who did not watch Cheers, even though I knew it was a quite good program, but I did not watch it regularly because I simply didn't want to be in a bar. I'd spent 20 years of my life in a bar. I didn't need to be in a bar, even with the good jokes. But that's personal. My impression is that just as only bad girls smoke on television anymore, there's very little glamorizing of the drinking. When Andy Sipowicz does it on NYPD Blue, we know he's in trouble and he's violent and his life is falling apart, and we're meant to know that, and we feel it.
You know, in writing about whether violence on TV actually causes violence in real life, you mentioned that Beavis and Butthead episode in which, you know, a kid had set fire to the house. And a Beavis and Butthead episode was accused of inspiring or teaching the kid how to do this. And you point out that when you were five, you burned down the bedroom in your house.
Well, you probably knew some kids, too, who played with matches.
Well, I was wondering how you managed to do it.
Well, I was just playing with matches, and I was trying to see if the bedspread would catch on fire. Well, it did, and then the curtains did, and then everything else. And the fire department came in the middle of the afternoon, and I asked them, "Do you have to tell my mother?" And they said, "Yeah, kid, I have to tell her when she gets back from work." But, you know, my point about the Beavis and Butthead as well was that that kid who set his trailer on fire, that trailer was not even wired for cable. So he had to go somewhere else in the neighborhood in order to watch Beavis and Butthead. And then you begin to ask the question, these are stupid questions, which should occur to anybody, that the kid who was wired for cable, who presumably had better access more often on demand to Beavis and Butthead, why he hadn't burned down his house, why the other kid did. Well, there might be something in that kid, and there might be something in that kid's family life. It's like I'm now go to the ridiculous extent when you hear about a new mass murderer, who, whether they've shot up the Long Island Railroad or whether they've shot somebody in front of NBC, you wait for the information, which you'll find in the third day of reporting, as to whether that person watched television or whether he'd gone to a movie that might have inspired him. And when there's no evidence of television, you say, gee, Jeffrey Dahmer didn't watch television, so I guess we can't blame that on television.
If I might just digress for a moment, I can't help but wonder what went through your mind when you watched your bedroom go up in flames?
Well, I was 5 years old, and I said, "Uh-oh!" No, what do you do when you're a kid and you know things that you've obviously been told not to do? Don't play with matches. I must have been told that. You are experimenting. That's what kids do. They take apart clocks to they want to put them back together. They just don't know how. Well, it gets out of hand. There are forces larger than you in the world, and you say, "Oh, Jesus, I'm in trouble." But it was no more profound than that. It was not, I don't want to exaggerate this, I was not surrounded by a flaming inferno. A bedspread was on fire, and then a couple of curtains were on fire, and then I shouted for the woman who was babysitting at the time. I mean, I came running, crying out, and she felt that she couldn't handle it, so she got a couple of fire engines. I had no profound thoughts except I'm in trouble.
And how deep trouble were you in? What did your mother do?
Well, you know, my mother was one of that earlier generation of single mothers who had to work in order that my brother and I could eat. So when we got into trouble, she tended to blame herself. It was that guilt of not having been there that she would blame. So I was not beaten. I was not I was not sent to a therapist. It was assumed that this was mischief that wouldn't have occurred if there'd been a more attentive parent around. I'm sorry about that, but that's how she took it. You know, I probably deserved to have my hand burned or something like that, although I would, of course, not do that.
Did you manipulate that guilt that she was feeling?
Oh, yeah. Of course. Kids are very smart at that. Very smart. But I look back and actually my childhood was altogether satisfactory. I enjoyed being a latchkey child because it required me to develop some independent resources.
Your new book opens with a quote from Andy Warhol, and the quote is, "When I got my first television set, I stopped caring so much about personal relationships." Does that quote have any personal resonance for you?
None. None. I just loved the quote. I thought it was very funny. I thought that it would signal, if anything possibly could, that this book wasn't going to be entirely humorless. It wasn't going to be entirely sociological, anthropological, alarmist, or deep think. And it was going to be. It was going to at least mention that aspect of TV that is a circus and a wishing well and a substitute for things that are missing. So that was all. It was to ingratiate the book at the very beginning.
John Leonard, good to talk with you again, and thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
John Leonard's new book is called Smoke and Mirrors: Violence, Television, and Other American Cultures.